Yes, may it please the court, I'm Fortios Bertzos, attorney registration number 10432, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Michael Radzinski, requesting that the judgment of the trial court be reversed in this case. The issue is a single jury instruction. It was a damages instruction, a non-standard instruction that was tendered to the court by the plaintiff. The defendant's argument was that there was already a pattern jury instruction, which was 6:1.
Pardon me, counsel, could I ask you to raise your voice a bit? I'm having a little bit of difficulty hearing you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court had already approved a pattern jury instruction 6:1, which was given to the jury without objection. In that instruction, it says if the jury finds by a preponderance of the evidence, it can award a plaintiff damages for any loss of earning capacity caused by the negligence of a defendant, such as Mr. Radzinski in this case. Although that instruction was given by the trial court, it gave another instruction that was not a pattern instruction that essentially took out a piece of 6:1, the loss of earning capacity claim, and then gave an entirely separate non-standard instruction on that regard. The defendant's position is that this violated CRCP 51.1, which requires trial courts to use stock or standard instructions unless there isn't one that covers a particular claim. In this case, there was one that covered the claim, because 6:1 was the only one that should have been used in this case. The defendant objected to this instruction on several grounds, including that we had a whole different set of language for the loss of earning capacity claim. There's no preponderance standard discussed in that instruction. The instruction says that the jury can award damages for loss of or diminished earning capacity to the plaintiff in the event or based on the interference by the defendant with the plaintiff's ability to earn money. The word interference is never defined by the court, whereas using the standard instruction, 6:1, negligence is defined. So we have an entirely different set of language and standard being put in here. The position by the plaintiff at the trial court was that this was language that was culled from 40 and 50 year old Colorado Supreme Court or Colorado Court of Appeals opinions. The defendant's position is that when the Colorado Supreme Court promulgated 6:1 to cover these types of cases, it certainly knew about the language in those older cases and did not adopt it. And therefore, it was error for the court to use this language when they already had the patterns.
Counsel, is it your position that there are misstatements of law in instruction 19?
Yes and no, Your Honor. The language, the interference language does exist in one of the cases. I think it was Moyer versus Merrick that was cited by the plaintiff. That was an appeal coming up from a lower court that said, the person was saying, I should be able to get these kinds of damages even though I wasn't going to work. So I agree that the language is there in the cases, and I agree that this is similar to what the Supreme Court is trying to do in 6:1, but it's different enough that it's reversible error because it not only does not define what interference is, whereas 6:1 and then 9:6 define what negligence is. It also leaves out the language about a preponderance of the evidence, which is contained in the stock instruction. So it's missing some pieces.
Excuse me, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just saying. And then it uses different terminology, such as diminished earning capacity as opposed to loss earning capacity. I think the legal error, and I understand the court's position that there's language that talks about these concepts in the older cases. The defendant's position is that it's not using the standard instruction does not use this language, and therefore this language is not appropriate to kind of graft onto 6:1. Also, the mere fact that it exists gives the plaintiff two instructions for the same set of damage claim when only one instruction under 6:1 is appropriate.
Mr. Bertzos, I read in your brief your different definitions of lost earning capacity and diminished earning capacity, or with the difference in the definitions between lost and diminished, and it seemed like you conceded that they were very similar. So I'm not. Can you explain how the jury would have been prejudiced by receiving both of those jury instructions, or what, how, if at all, it would have been confusing?
I agree they're similar, and I, as the court pointed out, but they're different. They're similar, but they're not the same.
Well, how are they different then, Mr. Pertzos?
Well, I think, as I pointed out in the brief, diminished is a lessening of. The 6:1 is in, couched in terms of a loss, which would mean a total loss. So you got two different standards there. They're not synonymous to the defendant, Your Honor.
If there's an instruction about lost earning capacity, why wouldn't that also embrace the concept of a partial loss of earning capacity?
It's probably contained within that, Your Honor.
Well, then how is it different from diminished? I mean, it sounds like you're basically saying that they're not different at all.
No, I think it's sort of a lesser included offense, if you will. The loss can encompass a total loss and a partial loss. Diminished doesn't even talk about a whole loss. It just lowers the standard and says diminished. So it's not a complete description of what a loss could be. So it's not a proper instruction.
Any issue in this case that the plaintiff was totally deprived of the ability to earn income?
Yes, there was an issue in that case. And
my understanding was that it was a question of her having reduced earning capacity, not that she had no earning capacity. Am I mistaken about that?
She had been working after the accident, so there was a discussion that she could do some jobs. There were a claim that there was something she couldn't do, but it wasn't that she was totally unemployable in the future.
So that the diminished language then would fit the facts of this case. Is that right?
At least as the way the plaintiff presented the claim, I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Okay.
The other part, there are several parts of this instruction. It conflicted with the mitigation instruction that said that the plaintiff could be, have her damages reduced for this loss of earning capacity claim if she did not get employment and keep employment to reduce her losses in the future. And on the one hand, we have the court instructing the jury that she can get damages if she never plans to work again. On the other hand, we have the court telling the jury that she can be docked, if you will, if she never works again. So you've got these conflicting instructions. The plaintiff never cross-appealed that other instruction. So we have diametrically opposed instructions, which supports the defendant's position that this was not a properly instructed jury in this case. The other things that were contained in here is the pattern instruction by law is the only one that is supposed to be used. Using the appellee's argument, if this instruction, the non-pattern one, is allowed, it would mean that a plaintiff could then take out from the pattern instruction those elements that are contained in the pattern instruction and then create companion instructions to go with each one of them. And that isn't the way the Colorado pattern jury instructions work.
Counsel, you're aware that various panels of this court have authorized or affirmed cases where trial courts have modified the pattern jury instructions on numerous occasions, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the Supreme Court has as well.
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
So why are you saying as a matter of law that it was an error for the trial court to make any modification to the pattern jury instruction?
This isn't a modification of the pattern jury instruction, Your Honor. It's the defendant's position that this is a whole new instruction, that we already have the pattern jury instruction. It wasn't modified. There was an entirely new instruction given in this case, giving the plaintiff two separate instructions for the same claim when one instruction was the only one that was authorized.
It's not unusual to have two separate instructions for one claim, isn't it? Is it?
It depends on the claim. In this case, the defendant's position is that it would be unusual because it highlights that claim. It basically takes it out of the language of 6:1 and says to the jury, take a look at this claim. It is different, and here are the standards to do that, including a way to calculate that element of damages that is different than the pattern instruction. 6:1 says, caused by the negligence of the defendant. The instruction that's disputed said, you have to look at the interference caused by the defendant without defining it. And in the defendant's position, almost instructs the jury to go ahead and award these kinds of damages by leaving out the preponderance of the evidence standard and by not defining what type of injury is susceptible of causing these damages. I'd like to reserve my other 4 minutes for rebuttal.
You have about 4 minutes and 40 seconds.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Kelly McCabe. I'm attorney registration number 10259. I guess I'm not that. I hate to be that impersonal, but that is my registration number. I practice law down in Cortez, Colorado, where this accident occurred and where my client, Anna Marie Carter, resides. The jury trial down in Cortez involved, as you all know, a case where Ms. Carter, at the age of 15 years, just starting actually summer before her freshman year in high school, was riding with Mr. Radzinski, the defendant in this case. He veered across the center line, struck an oncoming vehicle head on, and she sustained some pretty serious injuries. The testimony at trial established, and her doctors testified, that she had suffered injuries including migraine headaches that were continuing and severe traumatic brain injury and permanent damage to the ligaments in her cervical spine. One of her doctors testified that she had suffered a 25% to 28% whole body impairment in the accident as a result of injuries sustained in the accident. Dr. Tryon and Dr. King, two of the doctors, testified that she was not able, as a result of her injuries, to perform certain functions and duties that might be required in the workplace. This appeal, as Mr. Bertsos has indicated, is a very narrow appeal regarding one single jury instruction that was provided to the jury and instructed by the court at the request of course, the plaintiff in this case. And that instruction, we believe, is a complete and accurate recitation of the law. The jury was provided information that had been included actually in the notes to use on the jury instruction for damages. And that pertains to the difficult issues regarding proof of damages with regard to loss of future earning capacity, specifically and importantly for minor children and for others, because it's very difficult to know what we're going to do in the future. And I think these cases were generated from the concepts that established that people in the future didn't need to come into a jury trial today and say, and prove what they were going to do and how they had lost income as a result of injuries sustained in that particular accident. Cases, and I would point out they're not all 40 and 50 year old cases, although there's still certainly good law in Colorado, but the Moyer versus Merritt case was the Supreme Court decision that started examining that particular principle. It's carried on through Burris v. Freeman, and I think most recently that looked specifically at this issue was the Jones versus Cruzan case. And that case says that if there is permanent injury, evidence that a plaintiff is earning more money even after the injury does not preclude an award of damages for loss of future earning capacity. The plaintiff need not show that he could have earned more money but for the injury. Another decision that I pointed out in the briefs and I think is very illuminating in this particular case is the case of Stewart versus Rice. And in that decision, the court cites an older decision, but it talks about the fact that young people, and in this particular case, certainly the person was younger, and I think Mr. Bertsos points out that this particular plaintiff hadn't even reached majority by the time the trial occurred. In my case, in Ms. Carter's case, she had become, I think, an adult 2 years before the trial, but she was 15 at the time of the accident. The same principles apply, we would submit, and the the court there in Stewart versus Rice talks about the fact that the minor child would be impossible, who has not yet chosen a vocation or even started working, would be impossible for that person to present credible evidence regarding how much the future earning capacity would have been and how much she lost as a result of this accident, and therefore it was not required that she establish or prove any monetary amount of damages. Throughout Mr. Bertos's primary arguments, in his brief at least, he talks about the fact that there was no amount, monetary amount, shown or evidenced in the trial, and therefore there should not have been an instruction as requested by Ms. Carter in this case, and we certainly believe that that's not consistent with the law. I think a very revealing provision language from the case of Colorado Utilities Court versus Cassidy, which is cited by the Stewart v. Rice Court, says that where a minor has suffered a permanent injury and such minor is too young to have selected an avocation or begin to illustrate his earning capacity, in such cases there is no measure as to the amount of damages where such minor is entitled to recover, therefore, except the enlightened consciences of impartial jurors guided by all the facts and circumstances of a particular case. We think that is certainly good law, and that particular language is what led to instruction number 19, which is of course the focus of the appeal here today. We don't believe that there is a conflict between instruction 19 and the two instructions that were offered by the defendant in instructions number 22 and 23 at trial, having to do with mitigation of damages. Those instructions that were offered simply allow the jury, if they decide that there is a proper future earning capacity element here and damage should be awarded for that, to also, as proposed by the defendant, mitigate those, or show that the plaintiff failed to mitigate the damages and therefore should not recover some portion of that. It certainly wouldn't eliminate her recovery, but the jury was allowed by the trial court and to look at that mitigation of damage issue. There's certainly, we don't believe any inherent conflict in that. More importantly, I think the instruction 19 is the only instruction that is objected to by the defendant, and instruction 19 is, we would submit, certainly based on everything we've seen, I've heard a little different from Mr. Bertos this morning, there is not one case presented to indicate that the law set forth in instruction 19 is inaccurate, inconsistent, or inappropriate.
Mr. McCain, what is your response to Mr. Bertos's argument that the instructions were prejudicial because the jury was given two instructions instead of one about future economic losses?
My position would be that it is commonplace, at least in my examination of the law and experience, that courts are often asked to present instructions regarding theories of the case, theories of recovery, that would illuminate or touch on an instruction that is already there, and that they are certainly, a court is granted broad discretion to make those kinds of decisions, and trial court is, and we think that that's exactly what happened here. The instruction 6-1, the pattern instruction 6-1, is an instruction that provides absolutely no guidance or direction to the jury regarding what happens with regard to trying to decide what to do with lost future earning capacity when there isn't, when you have a young person who hasn't chosen a vocation, or where there isn't any evidence of what those damages might amount to. So we think the second instruction certainly was appropriate. I would point out that that Mr. Bertos's client submitted two additional instructions having to do with lost future earning capacity in his mitigation instructions. So he asked that that issue be further illuminated by the provision of two additional instructions. I don't think there's any error in that, and I think it was perfectly appropriate for the trial court judge to advised and instruct the jury regarding that particular point.
Excuse me, counsel. Those two instructions accepted by the trial court?
I'm sorry?
You said that Mr. Bertsos tendered two additional trial jury instructions. Were those accepted by the trial court and given to the jury?
They were. Instructions 22 and 23 regarding mitigation of damages, and Mr. Bertsos successfully presented those instructions. They were given by the court regarding the fact that the plaintiff could be decreased in terms of the amount of recovery based upon her failure to mitigate by going out and getting vocational training and by maintaining work.
I want to ask you about that on appeal here. Your opponent has argued that the your tendered supplemental instruction conflicted with instructions 22 and 23, which were tendered by the defense. Was that an argument that was raised by the defense in the trial court?
No, it was not. In the trial court, Mr. Bertsos' objection to the instruction 19 was that it was duplicative and it could be in conflict with instruction 6-1, the standard pattern instruction.
And how do you respond to the argument that it's that they're in conflict, those three instructions? Well, the 22 and 23 in conflict with number 19.
As you might imagine, I'm not here to praise instructions 22 and 23, but I don't think they're in conflict, because what instruction 19 says is, jury, this is how you can go about looking at lost future earning capacity. Instructions 22 and 23 tell the jury that if they find that the plaintiff did not properly mitigate her damages and did not go out and do things that she should have done, they could decrease that amount of lost future earning capacity. Wouldn't eliminate it, but I think the trial court was trying to allow the defendant their theory of the case, their theory of their position, and I don't think it is certainly an irreconcilable conflict between the two. It certainly, it just says, here's how you define and look at future earning capacity. But as far as mitigation of damages, if she didn't do some of the things that she should have done and had no care about that, then you can decrease the amount that you award her, which obviously we don't know, but it certainly might have been done by the jury in this case. Thank you. I have nothing further.
Thank you, counsel.
Yes, thank you, Your Honors. I will highlight there are significant differences between the standard 6:1. That one, the court instructs the jury, you have to find by a preponderance to do this. That is left out of the disputed instruction. We have a different standard of proof there.
Counsel, was there an instruction generally about burden of proof?
There is.
And preponderance of evidence?
There is the preponderance. There is that stock one, Your Honor.
Okay.
That was in there. But the Supreme Court chose to include the preponderance again in the damages instruction, and that was left out of the disputed instruction. The
is that pointed out to the trial court that was not included in that instruction?
Yeah, when you look at the transcript, what you're seeing is me telling the trial court, I don't like the fact that we're moving away from the stock instructions, and I believe this non-pattern instruction is in conflict with 6:1. And then it goes on to say, and other stock instructions.
But you didn't point out the lack of preponderance language in the new.
Not in any detail. I just said this instruction conflicts with the standard one, and we should stay with the standard one because it covers everything that has to be done in this case. And I think I highlighted, certainly in my motion for a new trial, all of these points that we're talking about today. And I brought all those up to the court with the citations, and including the argument, and I think a highlight point is in the Brittis versus Freeman case, the trial court eliminated that loss of earning capacity claim because the plaintiff had not shown any ability to go back to work or wasn't going to go back to work anyway. And the Court of Appeals reversed it and said you cannot take that out of the standard instruction, which for the defendant in this case is a good indication that that language covered everything, that modifying the standard instruction was not a good thing to do in this case, or in this case it was grafting onto the standard instruction.
Mr. Bertso, how do you respond to your opponent's statement that you did not point out to the trial court a potential conflict between instructions 19 and 22 and 23? The one that you're raising on appeal.
I did a motion for a new trial.
Okay.
I did that. And the court denied that motion. The other thing that's a difference in here is that in the 6:1 instruction, the court advises a jury or tells a jury that you have to find damages that the plaintiff probably will have. That probability standard is gone from the disputed instruction. It just says you may award future earning capacity loss. You may award this. It doesn't give them that you have to do this. And then at the end of that disputed instruction, it says, this is how you do it. You go ahead and you use the difference between what the plaintiff would have earned and what the interference by the defendant costs. There is no such instruction like that anywhere in the injury instructions in civil cases where the court is telling the jury, this is how you go ahead and figure this out. The way that language came up was on appeal years ago where either the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court simply said, okay, well, that's how you do it, but it came up on appeal. It wasn't given to the jury in that case as an instruction to say, go ahead and use this as a way to calculate damages. And the defendant's position is that it is completely inappropriate for an instruction to give the jury any kind of formula on how to do that.
But Mr. Bertsos, didn't instruction 19 use the phrase, if any, in terms of directing the jury with regard to awarding damages?
It did say, if any, Your Honor.
So how can you assert that the instruction was directing the jury to award damages?
Because it was, well, a couple of reasons. Number one, it's really highlighting that particular claim, and then it's giving the jury, here's how you go ahead and figure that out. So maybe the word directing is too strong, Your Honor. I think it's pointing the jury in that direction, and it's giving them a way to figure it out when that isn't part of the standard instruction. The main problem was that this plaintiff received two instructions for the same damage claim when CRCP 51.1 and the Goodyear and Vista Tire case says that the stock instructions are supposed to be used. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bertsos. And thank you, counsel, both for your arguments. We appreciate them. A decision will